Welcome to another edition of Pulp Nonfiction, the paper and packaging podcast. I'm Greg Johnson with Sustana Fiber, and as always, I'm happy to be joined by my co-host, Dr. Marta Pazos.
Hello, Greg.
So, Marta, did you know that according to iMark, an international market research firm, the global handcraft market was valued at $752 billion in 2022, with a projected growth rate of 9.1% within the next 5 years? Apparently, despite modern manufacturing's technological advantages, today's consumers are gravitating more and more towards handmade products. That's why we couldn't be more excited about our guest today, Alicia Wallace, the CEO of All Across Africa, a unique organization located in the San Diego area. Partnering with African artisans, All Across Africa markets their amazing handcrafted bags, baskets, and home decor merchandise through their website, as well as its select retailers, including Disney, Nordstrom, Ralph Lauren, and Target. During our conversation today, we'll chat with Alicia about how All Across Africa is energizing the handcrafted space while also helping both artists and the environment, too. Alicia, it's great to see you again, and thank you for visiting with us today.
Thank you, Greg and Marta, for having me. I'm so excited to have this conversation.
Alicia, I know we're all well aware that Africa is really big. In terms of size, it's bigger than the United States, Canada, and China combined. It's got a population of over 1.4 billion people, and despite an abundance of natural resources, including timber, diamonds, and gold, the African continent is still one of the most impoverished places in the world. With that economic disparity, how did you start All Across Africa? And if you could kind of walk us through your journey.
Yes, happy to. In university, I was studying economics, and one of my courses was microfinance. And so I quickly became engaged and enamored in how economics could be a solution for the poor. Something as simple as a $100 microloan could transform the lives of a woman and her family. And it was also during that time that I was traveling the world, backpacking Europe. You know, this was a transformative time in my life, my junior and senior year of college. And I built a bucket list of 103 things that I really wanted to make sure that I did in my life. And, you know, on that list was providing a scholarship for a woman to go to college, going to Antarctica, seeing the cherry blossoms in Japan, and going to Africa. And Africa, as in its, you know, 54 countries, one big continent, right? I didn't know where I wanted to go, but somewhere there. And I ended up getting invited on a volunteer trip with doctors and nurses. And it was from my hometown. It was, you know, a local community invitation, and it was 2 weeks over my spring break. And I traveled to Sierra Leone, and I went to a rural village in McKinney. And what I saw and experienced there, I came home with such a heavy heart and a brokenness around the lack of opportunity for men and women, you know, specifically women who were waiting in line to come to our medical clinic with a child that had fallen in the fire, you know, a three-year-old little girl, and had burns up past her elbow. And it wasn't treated for a week, you know, until we came with this volunteer clinic. And I came back, you know, kind of angry that I hadn't learned and been exposed to that growing up in the community that I was in the U.S., but also with a heavy heart and saying, like, now is my time. And so that set me off on a path to interview organizations, not interview at organizations. I was interviewing organizations because I really wanted to see where I was going to commit myself and what that looked like. And it was really around sustainability. I wanted people to be empowered. I didn't want it to be a two-week volunteer band-aid trip. I wanted something where people were economically empowered and making decisions for themselves, and that long after the work is completed, that there's transformation in that community that would be long-lasting. And so I ended up coming across an organization called Rwanda Partners. And it was a nonprofit working specifically in Rwanda, and the leader, Greg Stone, was trying a lot of different things. He was throwing stuff on the wall, education, reconciliation between Hutus and Tutsis post-genocide, and starting to dabble in job creation. And it was there that I really got the experience. I worked for Rwanda Partners for 3 years, and I got the experience on the ground. I was boots on the ground, living in Rwanda, getting to hear from the women at the school. Thanks for sending our kids to school, but what we really want are jobs. Like, we know the value of education, but the reason why our kids haven't been in school is because they don't have a safe place to sleep and they don't have food on the table. What's the value of education if we can't sleep, if we can't eat? And it was a very good point. And so that got us very focused on creating jobs. And so Greg and I teamed up together and we created All Across Africa really as a solution to poverty. But and then it became it's a retail company. So it's quite an interesting dynamic.
How do people feel about us going there?
Yeah, I think that there's some really interesting dynamics about, you know, foreigners coming into Africa. You can't just show up in Africa and expect something to happen in the way that you want it to. You really have to build relationships. You have to be patient. You have to understand their culture and their dynamics. You have to value them as a partner versus, you know, executing. You have to show up and just say, like, how can I help? But at the same time, listening and observing in different ways, because they might tell you something that they think you want to hear. And so, you know, they feel very mixed about us. They want the connections. They want to be valued. So by seeing us show up every day, regularly, providing fair wages, bringing them to the table, valuing their input, they're not producers, they're partners. And they see that and they value that. And now they're extremely proud of what they do.
It sounds like you've really built a solid relationship with so many of these artists. And as I understand it, Alicia, you work with over 8,800 artists. They produce about 1,200 different items, ranging from beautiful bags and baskets to even a new tabletop line that you've got. And I know you've worked with some premier retailers throughout the world, including Neiman Marcus and Nordstrom and Disney. How do you find these artists? How long does it take to train them? And how do you sell their products into some of these major brands?
Yeah, so it's morphed over the years, as you can imagine, as our business has. More recently, it's actually come to be that we recruit men and women who are subsistence farmers in poverty. They've never picked up a needle or natural fibers in their hand to make a product before. And we're actually teaching and training them how to become weavers. You know, the really tight quality and weave that I have behind me, if anyone is watching and can see it there, those products would take closer to like 4 to 6 weeks for somebody to learn to make from scratch. But we're also working with the product line with Target, where an artisan can learn in 3 days how to produce a product. So it's really incredible to get to see men and women 10x their income and the amount of like 3 days of training, right? It's just like, can you imagine someone coming to you and be like, do you want to attend a 3-day workshop and 10x your income? You would just be like, yes, please, right? It's an incredible opportunity for them and bringing them up to middle-class wages. As far as like how we have brought that to market, I think really our secret sauce has been with design. So I have a design team based in San Diego. We work with designers across the US and Europe, but then we also have a permanent design team, product development team in Uganda. That's been really integral and key to like connecting with these retailers, because we're taking this craft that we're finding in the local market or that we're seeing concepts made, and then we're bringing it into kind of our production and product development team. And we're saying like, is this possible? Is that possible? Like, how can we manipulate the fibers? And that's something that like a skill that I've honed over the last 14 years is like, I know African fibers and I know what's capable and possible. And so being able to really push the limits of, you know, natural fibers and making them, like you said, into anything. I have a sales team in Atlanta right now, and they're calling me. They're at the America's Mart show, and they're saying butterflies are the best product right now. And we've made these beautiful woven butterflies that are big pieces on the wall. And that's a trend that's happening right now. Bugs and butterflies are like big in home decor and different things. So connecting with these retailers means we're using these natural fibers, this high quality skill set, and then we're taking design that isn't just happening right now. I'm not just opening up a magazine from House Beautiful and saying, what's happening? Oh, the green behind Greg and the wall is like the color of the year. Like, let's design some green baskets. That's how I started. Now we're actually trend forecasting and saying, what's happening a year from now in trend? And how are we designing for that? So when we show up to the market, the Nordstrom buyer who's buying those green things from this, you know, producer can also find the same green things from us, so that when they're building their merchandising display, it's very cohesive. We've built a reputation for delivery, which is also key for these retailers. You know, they're a little bit scared to work with artisans. You know, we were pitching Crate and Barrel early on, and we knew we had an in to the founders, and they were like, yeah, thanks, but we don't really trust that you'll deliver on time or that we can get the quality and quantity that we need. And so we finally broken through that enough where people trust us. Our first customer was Costco, which provided a great platform and reputation for us to grow from there. And being seen in Target and Disney and Starbucks has also helped that. So yeah, it's really showing up with great product and having that reputation that we can meet all of their needs and have a clean supply chain is another really honest part of it. We have the Nest seal for ethical transparency, which means that, you know, we're paying fair wages, we're audited for that. There's no children in the workforce, and retailers can trust and be assured of that. And that's a really key piece for them as well, because we're not working in a factory. This isn't made in a big setting. This is made in someone's home, right, around their children. And they're doing it, you know, in a very unconventional way. Business as unusual is what we've been calling it. So yeah, that's a little bit of how we find them and try and make those market connections.
I would think with what seems to be trending with your retail partners and in the world in general, you seem to be on a pretty good track from a merchandising standpoint and having a bright future with that type of thing.
Yeah, I would agree. I think when we think about like life's greatest luxury, it's time, right? And so anything that's taking time, somebody's investing time to create, feels more meaningful. And we've seen a shift in consumerism going from Louis Vuitton and diamonds being the most important to people wanting to be responsible and also wanting to be known for being responsible. So they want others to know that they value time, that they value culture, that they value people. And so what's better than, you know, a handmade handbag or a woven tote or something in their home that someone's going to comment on, and then they can say, did you know this was from Rwanda and this is helping a woman out of poverty and it's made from natural fibers? One, that makes us look knowledgeable, right? It makes us look like we value people's time and all of that. And at the same time, it reflects our own values. And so we get to live in line with our values and have these things. And so we're definitely seeing that as an amazing consumer trend. We love it. And I think it's just in line with like when we all think about our most valued possessions, right? And me just moving my house, packing up all my things and kind of going through. It's like, what do I keep? What do I not? And it's like my kid's art or a painting someone gave me or, right? It's like, it's those things that someone's invested in and thought of you in the process. And so, yeah, we're really excited to continue to see where that goes. And we're seeing it go more and more mainstream, especially as we can deliver on quantity. You know, big retailers are looking for ways to incorporate that as they're also seeing that trend. So we're really excited for what that's going to mean for African employment.
I think that at some point or another, we all fell for this show-off product story, right? So you've made it because the handbag that you're carrying, it certainly says that you have a lot of money in your bank or that you are in debt. I don't know exactly. A lot of people actually break the bank just to show that off. But is there anything else that anyone could be doing so we don't continuously fall for that? I need to show that I have a lot, and I need to show that what I have cost me a lot of money.
I think that the value of storytelling and by telling others about it means that we are valuing people and that it's not about the same consumption as it was before, right? Somebody's going to comment on your Louis Vuitton purse or like, wow, look at those gems or those jewels, right? And you can say whatever you want about them. But now when they're commenting on them, it is still that reflection of that we're knowledgeable and that we care. And I do think that that matters. And I do think it's the responsibility of companies to help consumers and people find those solutions. You know, I think that there's amazing entrepreneurs out there working to provide those solutions and create those connections and think. You know, companies like Sustaina and making those every day. You know, I purchased Starbucks yesterday, Greg, and I thought of you, you know, and I had my paper cup. And it's just like, how do we show up in these different places and create these opportunities for consumers to have the right choice and to, you know, have something that is helpful in different ways?
Let's shift just for a minute, Alicia. I know you have mentioned a couple times sustainability, and I think that has obviously been a big benefit to shoppers because they gravitate these days towards environmentally friendly types of products and services. And certainly your merchandise fits that to a T. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the natural fibers in Africa that you're using? I know you mentioned before in our past conversation I had with you, sweet grass and banana grass and also raffia. Tell us a little bit about how you select which fibers to use and how they are used to make some of your beautiful products.
So when we first started, we actually were starting with baskets. So it was natural fibers grown in the local community. And so that model then shifted to how do we employ more artisans and how do we meet market demand? We started exploring textiles and fabrics. We were working with the UN, with leather, with different jewelry products. And in the end, as we started to really analyze and look at our supply chain, there was so much that was out of our control. We didn't know where those textiles were being produced. I would try and research these labels. They had misspellings on them. Well, what was happening was they were actually being produced in Chinese factories. They were copycat African textiles produced in Chinese factories, and they didn't want to be traced. They didn't want you to know where they were from. But it kept leading that question of, like, who's involved in this, and, you know, and what is involved in this production? And what am I selling to a U.S. consumer and telling them it's produced with fair wages? Okay, part of the product, right? But I couldn't ensure that the whole thing was. And so we actually started to get really focused. We started to say, like, we're importing things that we don't know where they are. The supply chain isn't clean. We need to get focused on how are we going to produce the most jobs and how are we going to be ensured that we're actually still doing the right thing for the world and people, not just Rwandans or Ugandans, right? For everybody else that's involved in this. Materials are sourced in the countries we produce, Rwanda, Uganda, and Ghana, but they're also sourced in Tanzania and Madagascar as well. And so, yeah, it's for us, it's just been getting really clear on what's our value and what's our priority, and then what can we make with that? And, you know, we keep exploring new natural fibers throughout Africa. There's so many. So recently we've been working with something called sage grass and fan palm, and that creates more of like a wicker basket type of look that's more on trend right now. So it's been really fun to get to go out and find these natural fibers and develop different capabilities for them. Water hyacinth is a very common one. We have water hyacinth in Uganda, and we're using that now. So yeah, it's really about knowing the source and making sure that we know who it is that's getting paid to produce that material, and then what home it's going to actually be produced into a final product.
Every time I think of hyacinth, I think of the Mediterranean. I'm finding it hard to place hyacinth in Uganda, which is a landlocked country, right? So
Lake Victoria is a very big lake, so that's where it grows.
Okay, so. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
What about the inks?
The dyes. The dyes are all organic.
The dyes, yeah.
So we source the dyes in South Korea and the U.S. and in the Netherlands, and we know the source of those dyes as well. Those are the things that are imported, but they're organic. They meet all the like Prop 65 and food safe and all of those types of things. So they've been tested and vetted, and we understand and know those sources. We have methods for reusing the dyes as well. So they'll be dyeing something like this citron color. And instead of disposing of it in our recycled wastewater treatment spot, they'll actually keep using those colored ones to make like the darker colors or to make black. And so there's ways that we're, you know, minimizing our even, you know, waste that we have to go and treat after to get more out of it.
Any plans to have those sourced domestically or to produce?
We don't
them,
have any or? Production abilities. Yeah, at this stage, the manufacturing for those is not. They make local dyes, but they are not clean dyes. They are not water safe and things like that. So yeah, we don't plan to go into dye manufacturing anytime soon. So I don't know who else is working on clean dye sources in East Africa yet. We've worked with plant fibers before to dye, so tea leaves, and there's a group in Rwenzori Mountains in Uganda that uses all natural things. The problem is they can't make the same color consistently. And you don't know if you can get 10 baskets that season or 100 baskets that season of any color. And so that just becomes really difficult for us to actually scale and create consistent employment in that way.
Alicia, as we wrap up our discussion with you today, I just wanted to ask you, what are some of the things you do personally in your everyday life to help the environment?
That's a good question, Greg. I think as we were talking before about just like making better purchasing decisions, I believe that small decisions really add up and matter, and that it's also consumers' demand that helps put pressure on companies to shift their focus as well. And so, yeah, just continue to make all those small decisions. And I'm not perfect, and I don't think anyone else is in the environmental decision-making world, but having conversations with others and friends and learning about what they're doing is also a good one. And yeah, just continuing to try harder.
I wish that most people thought like you, because at the end of the day, we all fall under the very big mistake of, oh, well, what I do is not going to matter, right? The impact of what I do. Yeah. But if the impact of what you do and what everybody does is aggregated, it will matter.
Did you guys see there was a photographer recently that took pictures of people in their garbage that they produced over the course of a week? And I'll have to go back. I'll follow up with you guys for another reference point. But it was astonishing to get to see an 80-year-old man. I think it was like, you know, some amazing photojournalist laying in his trash, a family of four laying in their trash, right? And these were just like the photographer just had them lay it all out and then they had to lay on top of it. But it was amazing to get to see, you know, because it's out of sight, out of mind. We just throw the stuff away, you know, we just order something and we open up all the packaging and then out of sight, out of mind. And we're not actually thinking about where it's all going and what's actually happening after it's removed.
Alicia, thank you so much for your time today. We're really grateful for this chance to sit down and speak with you and learn all about the wonderful things you're doing with All Across Africa. I think our audience really hopefully got a great idea of just the impact you're making, most importantly, on people's lives, just to really help people who are economically challenged, people who are trying to better themselves, and also the environment, especially in terms of the natural fibers that you mentioned. And I think kind of alluding to some of Marta's comments, I really think, you know, when we look at our consumption today, we live in a material world, obviously, but I think if we can take a moment or two when we're, you know, online or at the brick and mortar store and really kind of think about it for a second or two, hey, where does this product come from? How is it made? What's it made of? Is it recyclable? And fortunately, thanks to wonderful entrepreneurs like you who are doing a fantastic job, I think you're making those decisions much easier for consumers. So thank you and continued success to you and All Across Africa.
Thank you both. Yeah, it was great.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in today. And we hope you'll join us again for a new episode of Pulp Nonfiction, the Paper and Packaging Podcast. In the meantime, be sure to visit sustainafiber.com for information on all our recycled fiber products for your paper and packaging needs. Thanks again, remember to recycle, and we'll see you again soon.